welcome to the Peptide Summit. My name is Dr. Matt Cook. I'm with Dr. Corey Tischauer. My team was actually really excited that I'm interviewing Corey, and they said, we think he really knows what he's talking about. And then I spoke to him this morning, and that is definitely true. I'm super excited. We're going to talk in depth about Lyme complex illness, peptide strategies for taking care of difficult patients. I showed up to work, and I have all of these dress shirts that I wear for podcasts, and someone took them to my house. And so then Tanisha smiled and said, "Don't worry, you just look like you're going to a Mumford and Sons concert." So it's a casual podcast today. But so nice to meet you. How are you today?
I'm doing great. Yeah, thanks so much, Matt, for having me. I'm really excited to talk about peptides, something that I've been using a lot for the last about 3 years, and continue to do as much as I can to learn more for what we have available to us anyway.
Awesome. Tell me just a little bit about your background in terms of complex illness and stuff, just so people get a sense of where you're coming from.
Yeah. So I've been in practice for about 20 years. I originally started off with a goal of trying to work with the chronic illness population, the people who really had been sort of left destitute by the mainstream medical paradigm and, you know, the fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue world. And that, you know, exploration kind of led me down a rabbit hole that I described earlier to you as sort of representing what I sort of have as four bubbles in this chronic, you know, chronic illness Venn diagram, so to speak. One is chronic infectious illness, like things that, you know, we all know and talk about, things like Lyme disease or chronic viral illnesses, you know, fungal illnesses, parasites, all of that world. And then we have biotoxins. So that's the whole world of mold and heavy metals and solvents. And then immune dysfunction. We'll see like primary autoimmunity, but there's also a lot of just individual, you know, immune issues. And some people are just not geared well genetically or otherwise to deal with the environment or the organisms they encounter. And then the fourth thing, which is probably the most recent addition to what I do and a lot of what I attribute to having a daughter with hypermobility is the structural world and looking at things like, you know, Ehlers-Danlos and the connection or association of mast cell activation or even traumatic injuries like, you know, like TBIs and other things. So I'm always kind of trying to parse out what's going on between those four bubbles and how to individualize treatment to get people to function again and function well. So, yeah.
That's amazing. Okay, 100%. I'm just going to dive into some great topics. And so then one thing that's not a peptide, but it's sort of peptide adjacent, and it was the top of the list of stuff that we're going to talk about. And it's something that I think is an evolving area that we're interested in. A lot of people are interested in the anti-aging world, but I think it has some immune benefits also with rapamycin. Maybe give us a little introduction to rapamycin, how you think about it and how you like to use it in clinical practice.
Yeah, so like you already sort of alluded, rapamycin, as I see it, has two really distinctive roles and benefits. One is sort of for the general aging population and what we can see as far as its benefits in reducing overall, you know, morbidity as we age. And the other one is its immune modulating effects and dealing with the, you know, the increased, you know, antigenic presence around us. We're all exposed to a lot more chemicals, a lot more allergens. And then in the people that I'm talking about with things like biotoxins or chronic infections, a lot of these things aren't going to be completely eliminated from the body. So, you know, again, not to keep bringing up Lyme, but, you know, Borrelia, but any of these intracellular organisms that we're going to think about, Borrelia or Bartonella or Coxiella or Brucella, you know, TB, all of these things go on and on. these are organisms that we can't get rid of completely. So the goal, of course, with antimicrobial treatment is to lower the infectious load to the point that the immune system ultimately can sort of quarantine those things away and manage it to prevent it from getting worse. This is a long-winded answer, Matt, but rapamycin in this world, I use it after we treat people for that biotoxin or that infection to help bring back immune balance or restore immune tolerance, I think is a good way of thinking of it. Rapamycin in large doses is used in the transplant community to prevent organ rejection. But in low doses, just like low-dose naltrexone, it has wildly different effects without the same risk profile. It inhibits antigen-induced proliferation of T cells and B cells and reduces overall antibody production. And so this can be really, really helpful in conditions where the biotoxin exposure a person is dealing with is due to the presence of a chronic latent non-active or carriage infection that like can't be eliminated completely. And so the idea is that by giving it for say 4 to 6 months, you can break a cycle of immune activation and help the body reset its immunogenic sensitivity so that it has immune tolerance moving forward in the future. The other side of this, of course, is into the mitochondrial world, which is a whole different side of rapamycin. And again, in the anti-aging world, this is where they've really talked about it, but like what's really going on? Like, what are we really doing with this? And I really find a huge amount of benefit for people in the chronic illness world as well, because of what I call damage done. This idea that a lot of the people who finally find me have been suffering for a decade or more and seen, you know, a dozen doctors and they haven't really recovered. And so a lot of it is there's structural damage that may have happened at joints or you know, neuroendocrine issues, or ultimately you see this cell danger response as discussed by Dr. Navio, which is really cellular senescence. And that basically means that the cells are basically in this hibernation state. They're not metabolizing well, mitochondria aren't being turned over, cellular function is impaired. So rapamycin inhibits a key regulatory protein called mTOR that is what promotes that cellular senescence, and it upregulates NRF2 to increase mitochondrial autophagy or turnover and get that cell out of that senescent cycle. And so, you know, by doing this, we see the ability to improve the intracellular clearance of biotoxins. We see improved energy, motor function, cell-to-cell or paracrine function, and ultimately a restoration of the cellular function that can then translate over into, you know, the ECM and improved, you know, everything else in the body. And so, yeah, so it's a really wonderful peptide, and the fact that it's not injectable is appealing to a lot of people, of course, as well.
100%. Are you doing on the immune side and versus immune tolerance versus sort of an mTOR side? Are you looking at similar dosing?
Yeah, it's actually an area that I'm looking at exploring a little bit more right now. It's very dependent on the person. So a lot of the people that I deal with are really, really, really sensitive. So while it might make sense or in theory seem like, oh, we want to use higher doses to reduce that sensitivity, the truth is it's usually a better approach to start slow and gradually work up as we see improvement. So usually I start off in the more sensitive people at 1.5 milligrams twice a week. Sometimes we'll go up to 3 milligrams and even up to 5. But again, I sort of touched on this with you a little bit ago. It's a project I'm working on because at some level we do have to watch and make sure that we're not suppressing the immune system. You can do a standard CBC and just look at WBCs and your lymphocyte neutrophil counts, but what I'm actually doing is looking at the lymphocyte subsets and looking at your CD3, CD4, CD8, CD19 cells and actually asking, are we actually truly suppressing things? Are we causing problems? Because, you know, we don't want someone to end up with, you know, bacterial pneumonia or something like that either. So I think that there's a realm of functional addition into the sort of medical realm where we're having to use higher doses and having to be a little bit more cautious about that. But ultimately, it synergizes really well with a lot of other things that help that as well. I think I talked already about it a little bit, but I'm a big proponent of using low dose naltrexone. I think it's a huge asset for a lot of the people, provided they do well on it. And it's something I've lectured for the Naltrexone Research Trust before as well. And also using thymosin beta 4, using low dose immune therapy, using low dose allergy therapy. And in truth, even using Helminth therapy, which is a whole new world of discussion, because I've actually found some of the best benefit in restoring immune tolerance. But in those cases, I am actually using a little bit lower doses of rapamycin to prevent colonization.
So then, yeah, as a tool or as a concept, modulating and regulating immune function is sort of what this whole conversation is about. And then as you hear, there's not one exact dose. And then these are generally things that you cycle on and off of. And so then, and then we're going to have multiple tools and strategies of modulating on and off of those to begin to deal with what was going on. You know, we were talking, and I thought this would be an interesting trajectory of conversation for people to hear about. When you think about some of these complex infections, there's a question of A, is there an infection that's out of control that we need to fight and bring down? Or B, are we over here with an overactive immune response to maybe the remnant of an infection, but the infection is not really the priority? And when you said that, I was like, oh, awesome. So then we have to let's dive into that, because I think hearing about this is going to be an intriguing thing for people to begin to help them understand sometimes what's a diversity of how they feel based on the two of those paradigms.
Yeah, it's a huge topic. And ultimately, you know, there's this idea that just because we have a test that shows antibodies to some organism doesn't necessarily mean that it's something that needs to be treated. In the functional medical world, I think we jump a lot towards the idea of, oh, we've got to treat this, you know, infection, or we've got, you know, an early antigen for Epstein-Barr, we've got high CMV levels, or we've got, you know, IgG positive results to Borrelia or Bartonella. But a lot of those IgG in particular results are really reflective of exposure, you know, or past treatment. And it's a whole discussion into the world of like, what does that exposure mean? And is sexual transmission a topic? And I know we're not here to talk about testing, although I will put in a little plug for doing more on the T cell based testing, because
like I think labs.
Yeah, I do a lot with Infecto, and had the privilege of going to meet Karsten in Augsburg in 2016 at the lab there, and really have been using that testing more since then, because with the T cells, we're looking at a cycle that really represents the last 60 days, right? So we really can assess whether something is active versus just present. But ultimately, like in this world of infection or biotoxin, like, there's sort of this chicken and egg phenomena that happens. And this is basically what I describe as the difference between treating disease and restoring health, right? Because ultimately there's always some toxic insult that affects cellular function, and that can be infectious, toxic, or traumatic in nature. But it all affects the immune system, right? And so when we have a source of the problem that we can't completely resolve, we see this sort of cycle of dysfunction that happens. And it's characterized by, you know, the inability of the innate immune system to eliminate this toxic insult, which often causes an amplification of the adaptive immune response, which increases cytokines and inflammation, which further impedes the shift towards an improved innate immune response, which, you know, just continues to increase this cycle. So generally in this kind of chronic fatigue world, the goal is trying to find the right balance between eliminating the antigenic source of the problem by restoring innate immune function and or providing, you know, detox support, antimicrobial therapy or whatever, some metabolic support like ozone or naltrexone or you know, hyperbaric or whatever. Or the other side is promoting immune tolerance, like we said. So this is a topic that I have a lot of fun talking about and spent a whole lecture just describing this nuanced idea of, you know, the idea that every microbe in the body has, that's established itself as either a commensal or a pathogen, has a unique threshold at which the immune system reacts. And I actually think that there's two thresholds that happen. I don't think there's one. I think there is an infectious threshold, which is what we learn in medical school, right? And that infectious threshold is what load of that antigenic material, that infection or that toxin is required to trigger an immune response to guard against damage from that pathogen, right? But there's also what I call an immunogenic threshold. And this is the idea that the immune system is trying to prevent dissemination of something out of an area where it shouldn't be, whether that's in a cell or whether that's, you know, we've quarantined Borrelia or whether it's, you know, a commensal organism like Clostridia that lives in the gut or staph that should stay in certain areas. But there's two sides to that. I guess I'm rambling a little bit on this topic right now, Matt.
Tell me the two sides.
Yeah, so, you know, it's an interesting thing. And I've got a bunch of graphs, but again, the goal of treatment is either to, you know, treat the infection and bring it below the infectious threshold, right? So that the body isn't like seeing there's a perceived threat, or it's to raise the immunogenic threshold because for whatever reason, the body became more sensitized to the presence of the biotoxin or the infection itself. And now it's reacting at a level that it shouldn't anymore. And so I kind of describe there being four categories of pathogens. If we're talking not in the biotoxin world, we've got our commensal organisms, like I talked about, staph and Klebsiella and H. pylori and Clostridia. And these are things that have high infectious and immunogenic thresholds that permits their presence in the body unless they breach barriers, right? Or become really overgrown. And so almost all of the hyperreactive responses to these are localized, like things like acne or ulcers in the tonsils, or cross-reactive, like we see with pandas or reactive arthritis or rheumatic fever, right? And so the commensal organisms is one. The other three categories with, you know, I can go into detail, but there's invasive pathogenic organisms that are going to have both low infectious and immunogenic thresholds. That's, you know, going to be stuff like cholera or strep pneumonia or pertussis or meningitis. And we've got our parasitic and viral organisms, you know, Epstein-Barr, Ascaris, blastocystis, herpes. And these have low infectious thresholds, but high immunogenic thresholds. And that kind of ensures that these things stay localized or latent in the body so that it doesn't get overloaded or depleted nutritionally or metabolically, while also preventing, a chronic inflammatory response to a persistent organism that we're not going to get rid of. And then the fourth organism is the one I think that we see a lot of focus on right now in the functional medical world, which is these intracellular and cell wall deficient organisms. So that's going to be, you know, again, Borrelia, Bartonella, Chlamydia, Mycoplasma, Mycobacter, Coxiella. And these likely have high infectious thresholds, but low immunogenic thresholds because of the unique ability of these organisms to persist. You know, I'm of the belief that we're not going to get rid of these things. So, you know, the reactional type we see is characteristic of the body's attempt to prevent dissemination into other cells while minimizing inflammatory damage to already infected cells. So those are kind of the, you know, the ideas that I at least have. You know, biotoxins are an entirely different thing, of course, because, biotoxins have direct and indirect effects, either, you know, due to their, you know, direct impact on fatty structures like, you know, the neuroendocrine system or cell membranes in particular, or due to their effects indirectly on, you know, on the body and the, you know, the pituitary gland, the hypothalamus, and their effects on changing those neuroendocrine hormones like melanocyte stimulating hormone and VIP, you know, and how that whole downstream cascade happens.
Okay, good. So then let's take a little walk into mycotoxins as a biotoxin and VAP, because that's one of our topics. And this is a topic that's sort of near and dear to our hearts. So I'll be interested. I'm interested in your thoughts.
Yeah. Okay. So again, like combining peptides with either IV or oral detox protocols, right, is kind of what we're talking about. If we're talking about detox, we're not talking about the tolerance side of things here. And we, you know, and with the assumption that we all kind of know this idea, there's two sides to the toxin. You know, one is the direct impact on the fatty structures and the cell membranes. And when you have a toxin that gets into a cell membrane, it creates scarring, but that scarring, as I describe it, is it's not like we think of on the skin. It's basically the addition of long chain fats and odd chain fats that basically impair membrane fluidity. So you get these sort of wax plugs. I sort of describe it as like what coconut oil is like in your cabinet. It's not fluid, right? And so when you get these longer carbon chain fatty acids, we see an impairment of that happening. And then sort of like what you were asking about is this neuroendocrine effect and you know, how the biotoxins affect cytokine production by binding to leptin receptors and reducing melanocyte stimulating hormone and VIP and affecting all the downstream things from, you know, ADH and endorphins and melatonin production and, you know, the clotting cascades and all of that. So with all of that in mind, the peptides, it's kind of nice because the primary neuroendocrine hormones that are impacted are peptides that are available to us, melanotan, VIP, and epithalin, frankly, and really KPV should be discussed if there's a way to get it anymore, I don't know. You asked a little bit about VIP specifically. So vasoactive intestinal peptide, been written a lot about in the Shoemaker world. Obviously it functions as a paracrine mediator, as a neurohormone. It's been promoted for its ability to heal atrophied or damaged areas of the central nervous system, but it also helps to limit inflammation and regulate the immune response. So it can really be helpful because it does correct some of those inflammatory markers that we see. In particular, I like it when we see high TGF beta 1, which is which in of itself is something I really have fun talking about, because TGF beta 1 is sort of a weird conundrum of a protein marker, because it has both anti-inflammatory and pro-inflammatory components to it. You know, but we know that ultimately chronic elevation of TGF pushes towards that Th17 immune response, which is characterized by chronic inflammation and allergy or loss of immune tolerance and autoimmunity. So it really focuses and fundamentally addresses like what we're talking about right now for these people. And there are other ways to lower TGF, of course, and assuming that someone's not still in a moldy house, you can use VIP and bring TGF down. It works for MMP9, it works for C4A. I've seen it help address, steroid hormone levels in younger people who are clearly, you know, affected. When you see a 35-year-old with a testosterone level of, you know, 250 or 350, that moldtoxin is affecting it. So it can be really helpful in those cases, as well as, you know, the vitamin D pathway, which is a really fun topic for me to talk about as well with COVID around. Like, I've really spent a lot more time looking at vitamin D and the conversion into calcitriol, and frankly, the use of prescription calcitriol in a lot of these immune topics, which I'm going off track here. But anyway, VIP, it helps to correct T regulatory cell effects and definitely helps to regulate both the innate and adaptive immune response. And so, you know, if we're thinking about all of how these biotoxins affect these, you know, the pituitary and the hypothalamus, and everything downstream is being affected, there's sort of a temptation to say, I'm going to treat all the downstream things, right? And that's kind of the sum of the parts is greater than the whole. But why I like using VIP and MSH and epithalin is because you're working more from that top-down approach. You're saying, I'm going to treat and correct the neuroendocrine deficiencies, and everything below that should correct.
What dose are you doing for VIP?
You know, I used to start lower, actually, Matt. Anymore, I'm usually starting off at like 25 micrograms QID, four times a day dosing. But I'll go up to the full 50.
Are you doing a nasal spray?
I'm doing it as a nasal, yeah. I'm still using it nasal spray. I don't know if there's any injectable forms of doing that at this point. I will say that one of the things I see, and maybe it's more melanotan specific, is you can get sort of a sympathetic neurologic reaction to some of these when they're used injectably. Maybe you've noticed that as well. Melanotan in particular, I've really found it to be super, super helpful because, I mean, melanotan is alpha MSH. It's basically the primary hormone that we see affected in that Shoemaker cascade. But I think it probably does trigger histamine reactions in a lot of people, which is why I said to you, you know, whenever we're talking about the use of peptides in the biotoxin world, I think KPV needs to come up because KPV is basically melanotan minus that carboxyl terminus. And so it has an oral availability and it doesn't trigger the histamine reaction that I do see with melanotan, and not to say I don't use a lot of melanotan because I do.
And I think KPV probably also has some antihistamine calming effects also, right?
It does. It has quite a bit of it actually. Not quite as much as like Mlexinox, which is another one that we, as far as I know, can't get right now. You know, I think it's all kind of esoteric as far as where and, you know, I think I know all the sources, and then, you know, I'll talk to a colleague, I'll be like, oh, you know, like there's think about this place as well. So, you know, it's something that I'm trying to keep my eye on and, you know, what's available to us. But yeah, KPV does have antihistamine effects as well.
Do you ever see people react? How often do you see negative reactions from VIP?
VIP? If you start someone really high, you can definitely see negative reactions. I mean, there's no question. You know, some of the reality is you do need to monitor, you know, pancreatic lipase in particular. Like if, so VIP is primarily going to be produced by the pancreas and then secondarily by, you know, in the brain, in the pineal. I mean, in the pituitary, but because of its ability to affect pancreatic function, I have seen upper left quadrant discomfort happening or GI issues. So I do tend to screen primarily for people who have had a history of chronic alcoholism or pancreatitis and watch them and maybe start a little bit slower. But other than that, I usually don't see too many negative responses to it.
And then tell me, in kind of parallel to those things, your thoughts on epitalon in terms of this side of the conversation?
Yeah, I mean, epithalin's an interesting one. You know, I describe epithalin as a peptide that you don't usually see a lot of subjective you know, benefit or noticeable outcomes with it, typically. It's something you kind of have to trust is working in the background. And at least that's been my experience. Maybe you've seen that. It's something I've taken for quite a long time, and I don't, maybe I notice some things, but it's a pineal peptide, and it's one that we know decreases with age. And so typically by about age 40, we see, you know, a pretty significant reduction in epithalin as the pineal gland is not working anymore. And I think it's just not known very much, because we don't really think of the pineal as doing much more than producing melatonin and being a surrogate marker on an MRI, you know, because it typically calcifies in Western populations. But, you know, epithalin has known benefits with metabolism, with increasing sensitivity of the hypothalamus to hormonal feedback. It helps to normalize function of the anterior pituitary, and it regulates gonadotropin levels, melatonin and serotonin in particular. In the immune world, it's something that, you know, there's just not a ton of data on it, but there is some information that shows helping to normalize T cell function, something that's a little hard to measure, honestly, reducing uric acid and possibly improving pancreatic function. But generally, as one of the sort of upstream neuromodulators or bioregulators in this sort of biotoxin pathway, I think it synergizes really well with MSH and VIP, as well, frankly, as some of the thymic peptides to help support long-term recovery for people who've dealt with, you know, biotoxin.
What dosing are you doing?
Yeah, so I'm trying to think. So 0.3 mcgs every 3 days, or 0.1, I want to say, I have to look. I want to say it's a 3000 mic per mil. So I want to say we're looking at about 300 micrograms daily, or 900 every third day, depending on, you know, patients' willingness to stick themselves.
Okay, good. And the alpha MSH, are you getting alpha MSH to, and how much are you doing with that? Or tell me about that.
Yeah. So, I mean, alpha MSH is melanotan, right? Melanotan is, I mean, it's a synthetic alpha MSH.
Okay.
And I mean, yeah. So, I mean, it's, you know, melanotan 2 anyway. And I will tell you, there was melanotan 1 for a while, which didn't have the greatest success with, because the histamine response. You know, and we can go into the whole details of MSH or melanotan, but the primary issue with melanotan is it causes tanning. It increases melanin deposition, which is not always desirable in everyone. So a lot of times what I do, I'll start off with, you know, something like 200 mics daily, and maybe even increase up to 500 micrograms per day for somewhere in that 6 to 8 week zone. I kind of think of it as like priming the pump, right? You're kind of getting the effects of melanotan and ideally sort of opening that pathway to all those downstream issues. And then usually I'm going to try and reduce doses down to somewhere around 100 to 150 mics every day, or, you know, 250 micrograms twice a week, which tends to work pretty well from a maintenance standpoint, without like continuing to darken the person. You know, the biggest, I think, concern that we hear about melanotan is, are we increasing risk of melanomas or, you know, skin cancer or actinic, you know, issues? And it doesn't really seem like there's any data to support that issue. But it does take a while for someone to kind of come back to, you know, their normal skin tone after discontinuing it. But I mean, I found it to be huge. I mean, melanotan increases interleukin 10, which is kind of a cytokine I focus a lot on, and you know, whether again it's in the Helminth world or in the homeopathy world or in the, you know, in the peptides or whatever, because IL-10 increases Treg cells. It kind of has that opposite effect with IL-17, and that that Th17 pathway due to its inhibitory effects on IL-23. So there's kind of like a crosstalk that happens at that point, but it does upregulate IL-10, and there is some really cool data on melanotan's anti-inflammatory effects. And, you know, they've shown in models of IBD or RA or even LPS-induced, you know, fevers and inflammation where in lab models where they're finding, you know, melanotan has anti-inflammatory effects similar to prednisolone without the side effects of immune suppression. And we also get that improved immune tolerance by upregulating IL-10. So it's pretty cool stuff, you know, you know, I tend to like using it, especially when we see high MMP9 levels along with low MSH. You know, and we know there's not a histamine component in there. You know, the corollary, of course, to this is KPV. And so, you know, if someone's MSH level is measured and it's less than 8, which is undetectable, then I'm usually going to go for a melanotan or I'm going to recommend it. There's this sort of gray zone I kind of describe between 15 and 25, where sometimes it helps at lower doses. But once we get above, say, 20-ish, I know where to get KPV right now that, you know, Dr. Holtorf and the integrated peptides isn't have it. This is my plug to you, Ken. You know, I'd use KPV as an alternative because it still has all that anti-inflammatory benefit without the full neuroendocrine effects of melanotan. So we still see suppression of NF-kappa-B and TNF-alpha while upregulating IL-10. And it's kind of like you mentioned, KPV also has anti-histamine effects, but it also has some interesting antimicrobial effects as well. So in cases where we're thinking that the offending issue might be the presence of some carriage infection or a latent organism, KPV might be a better choice, in fact, than in the mold world.
100%. And then can you explain the MSH mold idea, the idea of why that goes, MSH goes down in the presence of mycotoxins?
Yeah, for sure. Okay, so MSH. So MSH is basically produced in response to leptin binding to leptin receptors, right? So when we have biotoxins, we tend to see those biotoxins binding to those leptin receptors as well. When it basically blocks the ability of leptin to bind, which inhibits, in fact, the production of MSH. So when we see MSH reductions, it basically, again, it has sort of this whole downstream effect on you know, everything from hormone production to, you know, adrenal function and sleep disorders and chronic inflammation and chronic pain and vasoconstriction. But yeah, I mean, basically, I guess what you're probably wanting to know, I'm trying to think of like how best to explain this. So certain people have, they lack the receptors to recognize biotoxins. So I kind of alluded to this earlier when I said that biotoxins have direct and indirect effects. So in the indirect world, biotoxins are normally going to be sort of phagocytized or consumed by our innate immune system and our antigen-presenting cells. And those APCs are going to need to present that biotoxin to a naive CD3 cell, right? A T lymphocyte. But what they found, at least if you look at Shoemaker's work, is certain people lack the HLA proteins on those CD3 cells to basically recognize that biotoxin, right? And that might be an oversimplification. I mean, a lot of that data is relatively dated at this point, but it still seems like there's some good data on it. So when you have the inability to create antigen-specific CD4 cells because that CD3 cell can't recognize that biotoxin because it lacks that HLA receptor, you see that biotoxin basically persisting and being reliant on the innate immune system. And it basically will bind to that that leptin receptor. And so these toxins create an innate immune inflammatory cascade by binding to toll-like receptors, which are present on all the body. And because of its inability to produce antigen-specific recognition, you get chronic cytokine productions that, you know, further disrupt this whole hypothalamic pituitary issue, you know, aside from binding of the biotoxin to the leptin receptor. Does that kind of 100% answer your question?
That's awesome. So thematically then, if we were to kind of go through this conversation, and I'm glad that you brought up, Infecto Labs and all of that stuff. I love them.
Yeah.
I'm glad we're talking about testing a little bit, and because clearly what your takeaway from this is nuanced and complicated. And sometimes there's this upstream thing where maybe we have the lack of some proteins that creating downstream inflammation, like for example, MSH. There could be infections that we're having an immune reaction to. There could be biotoxins that we're having an immune reaction to or not. And it is really and our immune system may be active or not active enough, appropriate, too active or not active enough. And then within the things that are in us, there's these sort of four categories. And then probably a lot of people have a little bit of all of those categories of infections because we have a virome and a microbiome and we're getting exposed to all of these things. And even I find in my practice, a lot of times you have two people that live together and one of them, they have the same testing and one of them has a lot of symptoms and the other one doesn't.
Yeah.
And it's all intimately associated with how your gut's working. So then basically, then the idea is to have a thoughtful way of working your way through trying to diagnose what's going on and then trying to work on treating these biochemical pathways. And then we've got supplements, peptides, and other things. But then basically, almost the most important thing, I think, is building a clear model of what you think is going on at a high level and then strategically working our way through these things.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. And I think that better testing is helping a lot. You kind of mentioned, the world of testing for infections and like the T cell tests, which are really great because they really do help to delineate that issue. And, I have a lot of pet peeves around some of the provider, and I shouldn't say pet peeves. It's really not that. I shouldn't say judgment either, but it's around like treatment of, do you really need to treat something for 3 years or 5 years or 7 years? And like, what are we doing when we do that? And I mean, I'm guilty of it. Like, I mean, I've been doing this for 20 years and I'm not going to sit here and say, I haven't had people on IV antibiotics for, a year or more, or I haven't done this for some of this, but having reflected on things at this point, it's really not what I tend to do anymore. And so some of the testing really helps A, to identify that, and B, to find out like, if it's not working, it's probably not that you don't have enough antibiotics on board. If you have, a few things, or you've got a bunch of herbs, it's usually that the immune system is probably not working the way it should, or there's some associated biotoxin, or maybe there's some structural issue. Maybe it's related to, again, a hypermobile issue, or maybe it's an emotional or something that happened in the past that affected the limbic system that's creating all these other issues downstream. So the T cell tests have been helpful at distinguishing resolving infections versus active ones, But in the immune world, there's some really cool tests that have come out as well. And COVID, I think, has frankly been a huge asset, both towards the, you know, the more mainstream acceptance of T cell testing, as well as our ability to further look into the immune system. I mean, I talked to you a little bit about a lymphocyte subset, which is really about as far as we can go with Quest, other than looking at total immunoglobulin levels, which is valuable. Certainly you'll find people who are low, but what are you gonna do? What do you do with someone who's like at 500 on their IgG? They're lower than that 610, but they're not gonna qualify as CVID. So you're not gonna give them sub-Q Ig levels, right? So there's this whole gray zone in that. You could test natural killer cell function as well, which is helpful if you live near the lab, right? Because as soon as that T cell's out of your, or those NK cells are out of your body, they're kind of withering. There, like I said, there's better tests. I don't know if we should, you know, if we want to mention specific labs or vendors. I guess we've already talked about Infecto, but Cyrex has a great lymphocyte map that I found to be somewhat helpful at identifying Th1 and Th2 and looking at Th17, which is, again, you kind of heard me, like, I'm really kind of obsessed a bit about that topic, as well as, you know, looking at natural killer cells and all of that. And then Bruce Patterson, who I think you're going to be talking with here coming up, you know, he's done a lot with Incell DX too in the long COVID world, and looking at this monocyte polarization and all of these, you know, individual cytokines. And it's an area that it's kind of literally the cutting edge of where I'm looking at right now, trying to assess like the utility of doing those tests and how good are they. Because, you know, as you know, Matt, like cytokines in your knee are going to be different than cytokines in your blood and going to be different than cytokines in your CFS. Like, so it kind of depends on what we're looking at, but it's certainly providing a clue in terms of how to direct treatment and what to do, in addition to doing, you know, clinical interventions.
Yeah, 100%. What's been your experience with long COVID and the Incell DX testing, and what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I haven't done a lot with it. We're just sort of starting into that world. With long COVID, I would be remiss not to mention Mark Cooper up at University of Washington, a professor emeritus up there who's done so much work on this topic, and really, you know, developed a really neat model. And I think you heard me talk a little bit about vitamin D, and I could easily get off topic on this.
Oh, go ahead. Because, that's okay. That's a good topic.
Yeah, because one of the things we see, I mean, we know about this monocyte polarization, this idea that we've got sort of like monocytes full of spike protein that aren't dumping their load and remaining in this, you know, M1 state. And how do you convert them back again? And there's also this observation with COVID that we're seeing a lot of reactivation of chronic viral infections, in particular Epstein-Barr. It's really interesting because vitamin D, like it's one of those things you learn in medical school and you kind of go, oh, that's simple stuff. Take your 5,000 IUs of cholecalciferol or D3 every day. But it really doesn't stop there, because D3, as we call it, which is really cholecalciferol that we take, gets converted in our liver to calcifidiol, right? And that's like really transitory. It doesn't last very long. And then that gets converted into calcitriol or 1,25 dihydroxy vitamin D in the kidneys. And all we've been taught as providers is like, hey, look at this in cases of chronic kidney diseases, look at this in, you know, in transplant patients, and maybe in some of these really severe osteoporotic cases because of calcitriol's regulation for calcium. But what's interesting is COVID and Epstein-Barr upregulates something called 24-hydroxylase. And 24-hydroxylase is this enzyme that impairs conversion of calcifidiol into calcitriol. So instead of making 1,25 dihydroxy vitamin D, your body produces 24,25 dihydroxy vitamin D. It's sort of like reverse T3. It's an inactive form of vitamin D. And the only lab who's testing it is Mayo Clinic, and you can totally do it. It's really cool, actually. And you'll start to notice in these cases where you like see this profound fatigue in these long COVID cases, you know, and lack of recovery, and you assess not just 25 hydroxy vitamin D, your standard vitamin D, but you look at the full vitamin D profile. You look at the 125, the 25, and the 24/25 levels. In addition to, say, a chronic viral panel, you know, with whatever LabCorp or Vibrant or something like that, you'll see that often there's a match with this. You'll see that there's an upregulation of that 24/25 hydroxy D. There's an imbalance because you'll see a low level of 125 active calcitriol, and you'll see high viral levels. And so something like I said that I don't see anyone talking about, actually, and that's why I wanted to give full credit to Dr. Cooper, is the use of prescription calcitriol in treating long COVID. And I have really, I can tell you, I've had great success.
What dose are you using?
Yeah, so it depends. So for acute COVID, we'll go up to a milligram a day for, call it 7 to 10 days. And there is more data on the ability of either calcifidiol or D2 or calcitriol in preventing serious death or progression to ventilators in acute COVID, right? Tons of really interesting data on that. A lot of it coming, a particular case in the Spanish literature, but I literally have a library of this now. As far as the long COVID world, I'm usually doing 0.25 micrograms BID for 8 to 16 weeks. You have to really be careful. It's not something that I would advise be like just you cavalierly do it, because you can create hypercalcemia. And we know there's a lot of things that go into calcium regulation, especially in the cardiac world. So if you do something like that, you need to measure parathyroid hormone. You need to measure phosphate. You need to do 24-hour urine calcium levels. You need to look at your metabolic panels, and you also need to make sure you're not suppressing conversion on the other side. So you're usually having to do both. And then there's the other side of things, which is like this whole topic that we're having, Matt, which is on, you know, these patients who have persistent chronic viral issues or persistent Borrelia or whatever. And you're like, I need to upregulate your innate immune system. So I'm actually finding that using 0.25 mcgs of calcitriol with cholecalciferol or calcifidiol, one of the two, and getting those numbers matched, you got it with all the lab testing I said, has been hugely useful, because zinc and vitamin D, in my opinion, are probably the two most important cofactors involved in supporting a healthy innate immune system that's designed to eliminate a persistent infection or put the genie back in the bottle, as I call it, when we think of things like EBV or CMV. Because I don't know if you're like me, Matt, and you've tried every antiviral in the world. I've tried IV cytavine, nothing works long-term in my experience for EBV or CMV. I think there's more to be said in the world of treating the immune system. And Paul Chaney really had it down years ago when he was dealing with chronic fatigue syndrome and using, Cutipressin and things like that to upregulate that same immune issue. And I think that's really what we should be focusing on, because the world we live in now with, all the biotoxins and all the things we're releasing and the recognition of mold toxin and who knows, is electrosmog and things like that affecting all of this. I think in terms of sort of 21st century medicine, the focus needs to be moving more towards supporting healthy immune responses in terms of preventing cancer, in terms of reducing the likelihood of neurodegeneration, in terms of all of these things. That's what I believe the focus should be.
I would 100% agree. And the interesting thing, that's the thing, it'd be like, if you said that there was somebody knew how to fix EBV in Africa, I would get on a plane right now and fly there and cancel my week to figure that out. But basically the only thing that I've ever seen be very helpful is regulating and fixing and balancing immune function, and basically raising the sea level of health. And then that sea level is a kind of a tide that it's actually coming in and out, but to the extent that you balance immune function, and then the immune supporting peptides, I think, have been helpful in that category as well.
I agree. And you know, the two peptides I use in a lot of these cases where I still see residual active infection, thymosin alpha 1 and LL37. You know, I love thymosin alpha 1, but I mean, you're talking to a guy who's been dealing with, you know, the treatment of tick-borne illnesses for a long time. You know, its ability to upregulate the innate immune system and T cell function and improving TH1 conversion to sort of reinforce that cell mediated response is the important part in dealing with these types of infections. So, you know, personally, I find TA1 can be really helped to improve cellular membrane detox, as well as treating active infections that the body hasn't been able to clear, like in Lyme or EBV or C. pneumonia. I've seen it work at improving NK cell function, like we talked about. It augments antigen presenting cell signaling. And so it can really be useful in particular in combination with other antimicrobials, whether that's, you know, Western prescription medications or, you know, herbal therapies. I find it really helpful. And in the immune modulation world, TA1, I've seen it really help in some of these sort of TH2 dominant conditions, like, you know, chemical sensitivity or lupus or chronic fatigue syndrome or that sort of atopic triad that you'll see with eczema and asthma. I've definitely seen benefit from that as well. And then LL37, another one. I mean, again, I talked to Mark about this. It's really interesting. If you've ever gone to even just Google Scholar or PubMed and typed in LL37 and COVID, really, really, really interesting stuff there. Because there's a lot on LL37s being the primary or one of the primary focuses on the cell-mediated immune system's ability to get rid of these things, because you know, LL37 is naturally stored in neutrophil granules as inactive precursors. And it's released in its active form when neutrophils are stimulated. And what's really interesting is production is stimulated by vitamin D, which is really cool. Exactly. Because we're all the way back into this discussion around how do you support an effective innate immune system? And so we just created this really cool cycle. In these, you know, these active COVID cases or these chronic viral things, I do like using TA1 and LL37 in these cases with prescription vitamin calcitriol and sometimes other things, right? Of course, like, you know, all the armament of things like, you know, major autohemotherapy or herbs or whatever it's going to be. So,
I had this great lecture that I went to years ago from a Hopkins professor that was talking about an analogy for neurological Lyme was drug resistant TB. And so then the idea is that for drug resistant TB, there was an antibiotic model, which would be like 4 antibiotics.
Yep.
And so then I said, well, technically, we're kind of having the same conversation, but like 2 antibiotics is the LL37 and TA1, you know, yeah. And then hypothetically, ozone could be 1, and then vitamin D from a certain perspective is almost 1. And so then we have all of these other, and then herbals, maybe you have a couple herbals, but combined that might add up to be 1. And and you know, there's people who really believe a chance to kill is a chance to cure, and so then that would be more of a, on an antibiotic side. But then if I was to put the whole conversation together, I think you're managing that thought process with the immune regulation process. And I would agree at a high level, you know, the Epitalon, and you know, there's both some injectable and oral versions of kind of the bioregulator peptides. And you know, one idea that I just want to maintain like a long-term conversation with you around is the from a pineal peptide, you've got pinealon and Epitalon and cortigens and another sort of neurological bioregulator. But so then to begin to think about them as a possible alternative to VIP, particularly for people who are reacting to VIP. So I had this whole conversation with Holtorf, and interestingly, putting MSA, putting KPV in there. And so then I think that there's going, this next year or two is going to be an interesting sort of journey of regulating in and around MSH and those pathways in the brain, which are basically, to some extent, at an epigenetic level, putting that genie back in the bottle, in the sense that at a from a transcriptome perspective, we're printing kind of inflammatory genes, and that may be because MSH is low, if we could start to balance that, and the nice thing about KPV is it's easy to take. You know, the melanotan does cause nausea.
It does. And sweating, right? Yeah.
Yeah. But KPV makes people feel better. And so then kind of strategically there's, and this goes back to kind of the overall arc of the conversation. We have all of these levers to pull, and COVID's involved, chronic viral stuff is involved, these stealth infections are involved, actual thug killer infections are involved, and kind of managing all of that and managing symptoms and then doing things that help people feel good just to get them on the journey.
Yeah, I'm curious, do you have a source of KPV these days? Because I have about 100 patients that would like claw their way to you right now if they knew that there was something.
It's challenging. but there are probably some options. Are you using CMAX a lot?
I am. Yeah, I do use CMAX. I've mostly been doing CMAX as a nasal spray, and have somewhat recently started to explore a little bit more in the injectable as a, which I actually feel like is helpful. But yeah, I mean, it's another melanocortin peptide, right? So it's sort of in that same category of KPV and MSH, and you know, especially you know, when there's cerebrovascular issues, or you know, there's some concern around impaired circulation to the brain, I think it can be really helpful. I think one of the issues I encounter with CMAX is I want to use it in higher doses, because I tend to find that more often, you know, especially in these neuroinflammatory scenarios, can be really helpful. And I really encounter a price barrier for a lot of that for many people, because you know, doing, you know, say 6 or 8 sprays a day, I think works great for a lot of folks, and they really notice the benefits of it in reducing inflammation. I mean, one of the big topics I think that in all of this is like this blood-brain barrier, right? Like we have like getting things into the brain, whether you're trying to treat an infection in the brain or you're trying to remove something, it's like a very protected area. And, you know, even like you're going back, you know, when you were just discussing the neuroborreliosis or the, you know, the Lyme in the brain piece that you just had the analogy to with the drug resistance TB. One of the interesting things I found, and I found this data from, you know, Brian Fallon one of his publications from, I don't even know, probably over 15 years ago from Columbia. And it just came up again with Tulane, I think, where they talk about dead bacteria or dead Borrelia being much more antigenic than live ones, right? And so again, you know, kind of bringing this full circle to your, what you were saying, like asking yourself, like, what really is the priority here? Is it really that there's still an active infection, or is it just that you're dealing with a need to reduce that antigenic load and or restore metabolic or neuroendocrine function to the brain? You know, and you know, and so that's where we get into phospholipid exchanges and all kinds of other things. But yes, Cmax and saline.
Along those lines, I will find that sort of the phospholipids, and you know, you can, you know, with whether you're thinking from an IV perspective is kind of an interesting one.
Yeah, I mean, we do it both ways, you know, orally, as long as, you know, it's well tolerated and you, you know, depending on how much you can absorb, but intravenously, we've seen a lot of benefit. There's no question, mm-hmm. You know, and, you know, it's kind of like the Plaque X model or Essential or phosphatidylcholine, but yeah, using it with glutathione and using it with phenylbutyrate at sometimes and you know, leucovorin and all of that. So
are you doing phenylbutyrate IV?
Mm-hmm.
How's your experience with that?
I think it's huge. I think it's awesome. It works great. I mean, butyrate's another one of the, like, I'm really focused on the gut these days, right? So like, you know, in terms of my sort of genesis through medicine, you know, I sort of like look at the infectious world as like, okay, I don't know that I can learn much more on antibiotics or antimicrobials anymore. So what else are we looking at? And so the immune piece is really the bubble that I'm focused on, which brings us, you know, into the gut, especially, and dealing with that. And so prebiotics and postbiotics are a big one, you know, long about way of saying phenylbutyrate, right? So butyrate and just orally, probably one of the most important things in supporting the T regulatory cells, because 85% of our T cells are in that gut associated lymphatic tissue. But IV, which is what you're asking about, phenylbutyrate has great penetration into the CNS. And a lot of the best data on that is on looking at ceramides, or this idea of long chain fats that we talked about, or odd chain fats that form as these sort of wax plugs in the brain, you know, and the evidence that the phenylbutyrate is actually breaking down these long chain fats and helping to restore membrane fluidity. And we definitely see improved cognitive function, and, you know, we'll do MoCA tests, or we'll do PROMIS-19s here to sort of assess for, you know, the chronic fatigue world or the cognitive function piece. And we'll definitely see improvements just by doing IV phospholipids with phenylbutyrate. And, you know, we can get into fairly high doses in some folks. So, yeah.
I find those, you know, it's interesting. A lot of people will say, oh, all of a sudden the world just becomes a little more clear, almost crystal. With the phosphatidylcholine, and then we're combining the phosphatidylcholine also with other, you know, IVs. And that brings me back to all, I think both of us, we've never met each other, but both, we're doing very similar approaches and very similar with a lot of things that are just balancing and supporting immune function. Like my entire, I have about 18 things that I drink every morning during all of these podcasts, which is amazing because they just bring one thing after another, but it's all gut health oriented, and, you know? And so then I like to tell people, I'm just gonna project manage the gut as a thing that we do, that is just something. And in a way, project managing the neurological pathways, project managing these biochemical pathways and optimizing and supporting them. We've got antimicrobial, we've got a kind of balancing things, we've got regulating things. But it delights me to listen to you because I agree with everything that you said. The long COVID pieces are interesting. Basically, just for people to know, I got a list of things that I was supposed to talk about, and we only covered like 20% of it, which means in the next month, I would love to have you come on the BioReset podcast, and we're just going to start a little regular conversation about some of the stuff. Try to keep making the world a better place. Thank you for being who you are. You're an amazing doctor, and I'm super impressed and grateful to talk to you.
It's been really great being able to talk with you, Matt. I'm happy to share all this information. I'm of the belief that, you know, not just what I can do for the people who come to see me, but as much as I can help to educate other providers and help to sort of shift people in the right direction, I think we're doing good medicine and going to help a lot more people that way. And I think this is all just knowledge that should be shared. So I'm grateful that you're doing these podcasts and these summits as well, because I hope this starts to change some of the paradigm in medicine and how we deal with chronic issues in general.
Yeah, you're listening to the future. So welcome to the time machine. Thanks so much. Have a wonderful week this week.
Thanks, Matt. Great talking to you. I look forward to coming back for sure.